start with that. So basically, just to kind of hosafa to yesterday, we discussed Rav Yosef Engel's whole diuk from the Medrash. And in order to fully appreciate it, you should really hear the exact words of the Medrash. You could look them up also, but it's a little harder to find. So I just wanted to share that with you, so I copied that down here. That if you recall, the issue was that the position of the She'iltos is one that comes from many different sources, and it's found in the Gaonim, it's found, Tosfos quotes it as the Tanya, and it's found in Midrashim as well. So it's found in the Medrash Tanchuma, and it's found in the following language. So it says the Tanchuma in Parshas Nasa, Simon Chavtes, Yilamdeinu Rabbeinu, Ner Chanukah, Shehoser Ba'ashemin B'yom Rishon, Mahu Bahadlik Ba B'sheini, Kach Shana Rabbeinu, Ner Chanukah, Shehoser Ba'ashemin B'yom Rishon, Mosif Alav Kol Shehu, Umadliko B'yom Sheini, V'yem Hoser B'yom Sheini, Mosif Alav B'yom Shlishi Madliko, V'chein B'shar Yomim, Aval Hoser B'yom Shmini, Oso Madur of Ne'atmo, Lama Kevan Shehukza L'mitzah, So that whole first part you're familiar with from the way it's quoted by the other Rishonim. Here you have that phrase specifically, Huxel Mitzvasa, which is significant. And then what Rav Yosef Engel emphasizes is the next line, which seems to be so random and seems to be out of nowhere. So then the Medrash continues, Lo Yomer Adam Eini Mekayim Mitzvah Sekenim. Person shouldn't say, I'm not going to follow the words of Chazal. Ho of Einun Amar L'Makarish Baruch Hu. That they don't think they're important. Karsh Baruch says, no, that's not a legitimate thing to say. That's a pasuk in Parsha Shoftim. Lomar Sha'afal Divrehem Ani Maskin. Shenamar V'Tigzer Omer V'Yakim Lach. It's a pasuk in Eov. So it's really very interesting, and there's a lot of significance to this juxtaposition. So what Rav Yosef Engel was emphasizing is this seems kind of random. So here we're talking about using oil left over for the Hanukkah candles, and all of a sudden you get this mushrishmuz that, by the way, don't think you don't have to listen to Chazal, you do, because the Pasuk says, Sisa kasher yarucha, and then he quotes this Pasuk in Eov, which basically means you will say something, you will make a gezeira, so to speak, and it will be upheld. So explains to Joseph Engel, as we mentioned yesterday, but just to see it in this context, that one could have thought that Chanukah is a din d'rabbanan, so maybe all those other achronim are right, that Chazal have authority over a person, they don't have authority over the world, so they can't change what a object is. So there's no object status through a din d'rabbanan. So you would think, okay, so there's no concept of huxel mitzvah. So if you decide to use an object for a mitzvah, it's not going to take on a status of huxa if it's a mitzvah derabbana. So the Medrash comes to tell us the chiddush that no, that even in such a context, you could have huxel mitzvah. So, and that emphasizes that when it comes to din derabbana, and so we're obligated because we have sisa kasher yarucha, but Kadosh Baruch Hu is saying that he agrees. He is very enthusiastic about this, that he's maskim al yada. So it's interesting, and Rav Yosef Engel is the minority view here, but it really is a very striking medrash. It pretty much seems to spell out his position, that which the Chazal ordained, so then HaKadosh Baruch Hu comes afterwards and he essentially upholds. And that's what the Medrash is telling you, and that therefore there is a Chefza impact also, and you could have such a concept of Huxla Mitzvasa. So it's striking, it's Kedai to see the Medrash inside. So what essentially emerges is that there are a few different Shitas, at least, let's say, three, some count differently, but let's say at least three Shitas about what the status is of usage of oil from a Hanukkah candle. You have the view of the Rif and the Ran and the Rashba building on the Rif that seems to assume that after the Hanukkah candle is run its course for that night, if it's been burning for long enough, after a half hour, so then you can extinguish it, and they're assuming that means therefore you can use the oil, which a little bit of a questionable assumption, but that's how they read it. The other extreme, we have the view of the She'iltos quoting that Medrash, that the oil can never be used even after Yantif has to be destroyed. And in the middle, there are others, such as the Riaz. The Riaz, they didn't put us on Marmar Komos, and the Shulte Givorim, and Daftes, Bedape Harif over here, has an in-between position that the status is similar to an Esrog, similar to a Lulav, that you can't use it during Yantif, but after Yantif, you can. After Yantif, it's permissible, just like the Sukkah and the Lulav and Esrog are permissible. And of course, that highlights the question that we started to talk about yesterday. I think just as we're running out of time, we started to talk about, you know, why is it that according to the She'ilto's position, it's not that way? And we could ask the question of the comparison to Sukkot, all the mitzvahs of Sukkot. We could ask it from a couple of different directions. Each one of these points looks at it differently. Because on Sukkot, all of the Sukkah mitzvahs are usur for all of Yantif, for the most part. There's a lot more to say about how exactly that happens, when they become usur. It's a little bit of a longer discussion, but they're essentially usur for all of Yantif. So then the question is, so why don't we say that either at least that much we should say for Hanukkah, or why don't we say only that much? So here the Shultis is going much further and saying that it's usur forever. So we started to say yesterday that the Ran has his distinction, other Rishonim have as well, that when it comes to Neris Chanukah, it's basically a function of the attitude of the Haktzah, that when a person lights Chanukah candles, he assumes that they're going to be used up. And if they are, if they're not, so then that's a surprise to him. So whatever was put in there, he expected it to be dedicated to the mitzvah. So it's his dedication that makes it all usur. And when it comes to the Sukkah, he knows that Sukkot will eventually end and the object will still continue to exist. So therefore, he was limited in how much time he assigned to the mitzvah. And when it comes to Shabbos, Shabbos is different because Shabbos, you are nene from it at the time. So we're not going to say that the mitzvah status is going to create such a problem. Tosfos on Daf Mem Dalet Amud Aleph here that we saw yesterday a little bit also is similar, but it's a little bit different. It also kind of highlights a little bit the Asur L'Shtamish La'ora issue. That it says Tosfos, the Amari, the Ner Chanukah, Ikaro, Lo Lahanasa, Ba, El La Persumenisa, Umishim Chavivusa, the Neis, Eno Mitzape, Shiachabe, Ella Maxa Vagamri, the Mitzvah, Avel Ner Shabbos, Lahanasa, Ba, Yoshev, Mitzape, Shiachabe. So there's a difference in a couple of levels between the Ner Chanukah and Ner Shabbos, that Ner Chanukah were never meant for usage, they were there for Persumei Nisa, and that type of usage you want to continue because of the Chavivus of the Mitzvah. Neir Shabbos are much more practically oriented, and you're using them when they're lit, and therefore also you don't necessarily want them to continue beyond their usage. You don't want to necessarily continue for them to burn. So you are interested in them going out. Theoretically, you can't do anything to make that happen on Shabbos, but you're interested in having them go out and therefore have remaining oil because there's no issue of mitzvah to have them burn. And even when the mitzvah was going, it's not going to be prohibited in the first place. So for that difference, we have different halachas when it comes to Neir Shabbos and Neir Chanukah. There's a Talmud Chacham in Eretz Yisrael, Rav Leo Schlesinger, who many people are familiar with his writings. He has a couple of volumes on Chumash, and he's very, very prolific. He's written a couple of sets of Svarim on Chumash, and he has Shilas from Chubis, Chubis Shaul and Darshan, and he also has a lot on the Moadim, many, many volumes. So he has a Sefer, Ner Isha Beso, where the whole Sefer is about Hanukkah, so he has a few essays about this. He suggests also that when it comes to Hanukkah, there's an additional difference between Hanukkah and Ner Shabbos, that Hanukkah, since there is a shir, so your intent is that at least it should keep going for the time of the shir. And when it comes to Neir Shabbos, there isn't really any shir at all. It's just they're supposed to be there when you're functioning with it. So your intent is only going to be relevant during the time that it's actually functioning. We started to mention yesterday the writings of Rav Tertzin, with Aaron Moshe Tertzin, the Talmud of the Bris Kerav, the author of the Sefer Quintus Chanukah Megillah. So he suggests within the various views in the Rishonim here that the position of the Ran and the Rif, that there isn't really any ongoing Isser Hana beyond the initial half hour, is the assumption that since we say hadlaka osa mitzvah, so therefore the haktzah is just for that process of the hadlaka. And that's really the whole story. While the she'iltos, as the other Rishonim explain, feel that you dedicate this oil completely, that's your intent, to the mitzvah. And the in-between view of the Riaz, the Shiltei Givorim, that's only for Yontif, is that you want to include in your Haktzah whatever extra kiyum there might be. But beyond Yontif, when there isn't any opportunity to, beyond Chanukah rather, when there isn't any opportunity to be Mekayim anything, so then that's not included in the Haktzah. So three different versions of the attitude, just a minimal position because the Havakah is a mitzvah, so just for that first half hour, and that's it. The Riaz position that it should continue at least when the mitzvah is possible on some kiyum level, so for all of Chanukah, and the position of the She'iltos that you dedicate it completely for this purpose, and then it should be permanently problematic. So far, so good? Everyone following? Okay, just to mention a few more points, Rav Sternbuch, and say for Moed and Muzmanim, he has a suggestion there also that he thinks that part of the issue with the oil of the Chanukah candle is that it's hard to differentiate between what's used for the mitzvah and what's not, because oil is a liquid, so it's all mixed in. So at any point, all of the oil is being used to burn. How do you decide when you're lighting oil that some of it is part of the mitzvah and some of it isn't? It's all one pool, so it's all one thing. So therefore he thinks the very nature of Shemen is you have to say it's all participating in the oil at every given second. Any second this candle is burning, all of it is contributing to the mitzvah. And that's where you get a position like the She'iltos, that you're going to say that whatever has been used in this context is going to have a mitzvah status applied to the whole thing. So then for a moment he raises the question, so maybe if that's the issue, we should make a distinction between oil and candles. So that's true about liquids, but maybe if you have a solid wax candle, so it's not necessarily the case that it's all part of the burning process. A little bit of a funny chiluk, but he, in the end he rejects that distinction because he notes that there is a hiddur, once you're using candles, there is a hiddur to use long candles. So that means the whole length of the candle, everything is a part of the mitzvah also, at least on an additional level. So even when it comes to candles, we'd say that even the solid item is all participating right now in the Kiyum HaMitzvah, so what's ever left is hard to separate it out from what's actually been used in the process of Neris Chanukah. So it's also interesting, the question is raised that why don't we say that when it comes to Neris Chanukah, so we have a principle, Tashmishei Mitzvah, are normally Mizrakim, that if you have something that's used for a mitzvah as opposed to something that is holy, like a Sefer Torah or a mezuzah or something like that, but something that's like tzitzis, Tashmishei Mitzvah, normally the halacha is that if it's no longer used for a mitzvah, you can throw it out. We assume you shouldn't throw it out, Derech Bizayon, you should wrap it up in something nice, but strictly speaking, you can dispose of it. So why is it different then, according to the way the Shulchan Aruch paskins, about the oil, that it has to be burnt, whatever's left? So the suggestion could be, the Abidram says, that Neris Chanukah is different than other mitzvos, because since it's comparable to the Ner of the menorah of the Beis HaMikdash, so therefore Chazal conferred upon it a Kedusha-like status, and therefore we treat it like that. We treat it like it has Kedusha, so it has a greater Chumrah than a normal Tashmish Mitzvah. This is an idea that seems to appear in a couple of contexts. So we started to say yesterday also that it seems like there's a contradiction in the Shulchan Aruch, because the Shulchan Aruch paskins, apparently like the She'iltos, that whatever you have left over you have to use for the next day or burn in the end. And you also seem to paskin like the Rif by saying that after it's been going for more than a half hour, you can extinguish it. So how do you reconcile those conflicting psukim? So we started to say yesterday that the Taz points out two answers. One answer is that this answer, the first answer is really meduyak in the Shulchan Aruch. If you look at it in the Shulchan Aruch, it seems like this is what he's saying, that if you put in more than you need for a half hour, then whatever is left over afterwards is not considered to be part of it. The only issue is when you put in exactly how much you need and it goes out in the middle, so then what's left is considered to be hooks and mitzvaso. But if you have more than a half hour's worth, that's not the case. And that's not then the full position of the shiltos. That's a distinction within the shiltos position, right? Which could be that you could divide the shiltos position then and now into a couple of permutations, in which case we'll have a few more shitas. There's ramifications in this, these explanations within the Shulchan Aruch. So we just said a minute ago from Rosh Starbuch is assuming that like this, assuming that it was all a part of the mitzvah, but the Taz's first answer is not that way. Or the second answer he quotes from the Ma'ariyah, that if you have it depends what your intent is, that if your intent is to use it for the mitzvah, so then that's going to be a part of the mitzvah even afterwards. And if you have an intent that it should only be for the time of the mitzvah and not beyond, so then that will spare the leftover oil. So in terms of his first approach, he does note that the Gemara in Sanhedrin says that if you have a beged that you're making for a mace, a shroud basically. So the halacha is shrouds are asur b'hana. So what happens if you designate an item for a shroud? So then it comes out from the Gemara that only that which he ends up actually needing becomes asur b'hana, and that which is left over doesn't have the status. So then what's the difference with the oil here? So the comment to the Chachma Shlomo is Rav Shlomo Kluger, his commentary to the Shulchan Aruch over there. The two comments, by the way, it's Tafresh Ayin Zayin, the Shulchan Aruch talks about not using the extra oil, and it's Tafresh Ayin Beis, where he says you can extinguish after a half hour. So over there, the Chachma Shlomo comments, in response to the question by Beged LeMeis, says that there is a difference, that Chanukah has a status like Kodesh. That's basically the view building on the Balamor. Rav Vosner, who's not fully accepting of this, notes that it only works according to the Balamor, he thinks, but that the Balamor's position seems to be that Neres Chanukah treated like Kedusha. And Kedusha, we have a principle that Hazmoni have Guf HaKedusha, when an item itself is Kodesh, so we say Hazmana Milsa, which means that we say that if you dedicate this item for a Kadosh purpose, even if you haven't actually used it yet, it attains Kedusha status. So the language Hazmana means it's been set aside, it's been invited, so to speak, to be Kodesh, so then it has that Kedusha status. In general, it's Machlokus in the Gemara and Sanhedrin and elsewhere, whether we say Hazmana Milsahu, if you set aside something for a certain purpose, does that have the same status as using it for that purpose, and the halachic ramifications will therefore ensue. So if we assume that yes, Hazmana Milsa by Guf HaKadusha, by something that's set aside for Kadosh purposes, so that's what the Chachma Shlomo says, that Neres Chanukah are considered Kadosh for this purpose. Hi.
So I understand the discussion in terms of Hoktzip. When we talk about, let's say, Chepet Shal Kedusha, so we ran this similar problem with the Shofar. So here, you want like fire, you want a flame, but to say that the candles are the would be that sort of that Chepet Shal Kedusha or the menorah itself, is that more move similar to what we saw with the Shemiyah versus the Kiyah of the Shofar?
Well, a couple of distinctions. The first of all, when it comes to the Shofar, so I don't think anyone actually assumes that's a Chepet Shal Kedusha. Question is a Chav Shal Mitzvah, right. So that's already a different status, because that's part of, that wouldn't be the same halacha as this. But there, then the distinction you're focusing on is that there was a strong possibility that it's not even called Chav Shal Mitzvah, because the sound is the mitzvah, not the object. So here, what would you say is the mitzvah? The
look, I don't the know picture? What does it mean, having the a mitzvah. Fire? I don't know if that was a mitzvah, I don't know.
But the fire only exists, and only continues to exist as a extension of the candle. It's part of the candle. The candle
yeah,
is the flame.
The coal versus that.
Coal can be disembodied. It's you blow it, and then it floats through the air. You know, it doesn't have any mamash.
It's always
on
the candle.
The fire is there, but it's an extra chiddush. What he's saying here, he's not just addressing that point, but then he's saying that not only is it a mitzvah, but it's kedusha. Rav Vosner has a lot about this. We won't be able to discuss everything. He has in the Sefer on Chanukah. He has two long essays about the related issues about the Hoktzel and Mitzvah. So he doesn't love this Chachma Shlomo. He has a couple of kashas on it. but just what's also relevant in Yana Dioma is the Chachma Shlomo says. It says there are three mitzvahs like this, that Hanukkah is one of them, and the other two that he mentions relevant in Yana Dioma and in Yanenu. So Sukkah, the Gemara says in Daf Tes and Sukkah, the Gemara learns from a pasuk that Chal Shem Shamayim Ala Sukkah. Sukkah is a Kodesh place, which parenthetically gives you room for a lot of interesting drushes about the nature of the sukkah. Sukkah clearly has a very unusual type of blend of concepts, because it's dafka, supposed to be your residence during sukkahs, but it's also a kodesh, which is the opposite of being your residence. But that's what the Gemara says, that chal shem shamayim ala sukkah. That was how the Lubavitcher Rebbe explained that the Lubavitcher Hasidim have a practice not to sleep in the sukkah. So every year in the Allgemeiner Journal, which is a Lubavitch run newspaper, so they print a full page ad. I haven't checked in the past few years, but I remember reading it as a kid. They print a full page ad explaining why it is that the Lubavitchers don't sleep in the sukkah on sukkahs. So they quoted the Rebbe as saying, or you know, they printed from the Rebbe to say that the sukkah is so holy, it's so kodesh, it's not possible to sleep there. It's too holy an environment, so that's what you could question about that, but that's working off this premise that the sukkah does present this paradox. On the one hand, it's supposed to be your dira, at the same time, the Gemara does that say that chal shem shamayim ala sukkah, that it has this kodesh status for whatever intents and purposes. And then the Gemara has a hekesh between sukkah and lulav and esrog. So he assumes these three mitzvahs, menorah, sukkah, and lulav, all have a surprising kodesh status. It's not like normal kinds of kedusha, like a sefer Torah, tefillin, or korban, or something like that, but there's something about them that is comparable to kedusha, so we don't treat them like a mitzvah object, we treat them a little bit more, and hazmana milsa in that category. If you'd like to see a beautiful drasha on the concept of Hazmana Milsa as applied to Jewish people, you should take some time over Yontif to read the introduction to the Tshuvas Beis Halevi. A lot of interesting things in the introduction to Tshuvas Beis Halevi, but in part of that, he has a beautiful drasha on this concept of what it means to be set aside for Kedusha even before you start involving yourself in holy purposes, and how the Jewish people are in that category. So definitely feel free to take a look. If you have a few minutes over Yontif, the Sefer is available, as we know, and you can then plug it back into here. Hi.
How does this fit in with the general pattern when we have the Tashmishe Mitzvah and Kedusha of the Chiluk being Pesukim?
This is a Chiddush. There's no question that this is not the standard understanding. And again, Rav Osner himself doesn't like it so much. He says when it comes to Hanukkah, it's only works with the Chiddush of the Baal HaMor, and he doesn't think the other Rishonim would go so far. And Sukkah also, you have to say that it's an extra Chiddush, there's a riboy from this Pasuk, that normally you wouldn't assume that there is Kedusha to this mitzvah. So that's really what's the Sad HaShava, I mean, these three mitzvahs, these are not your normal models of what would be defined as Kedusha. If you took them on their own, it would look like mitzvah chetzah, and the notion that there's some kind of Kedusha to them is the Chiddush. Is something that is a little bit surprising. So that could also be relevant, just mention another issue or two. The Maisa, if we can leave over Hanukkah candles from one night to the next, according to everybody, and use it for the next night, so why do we have to burn it after the eighth day? Why don't we save it for next year somewhere, put it away, and use it 51 weeks later? So the Mishnah Berurah writes that we're worried about takala. We don't trust ourselves to be able to keep the oil around for so long and not use it for something else. That's a stumbling block, so that's not an acceptable option for practical reasons. We can save it from one day to the next, but to save it for almost the whole year, we don't think we're capable of doing that. So that prompts the question, which the Poskim can talk about, or Vosner talks about as well, and the others discuss, that the status of the oil that it needs to be burnt, again, according to the Psak of the Shulchan Aruch, so does it need davka to be burnt, or is that just an example? Maybe you could bury it. That you find the Gemara and Maseches Tevurah has different categories. You have that which is Misrafin, davka, and that which is Nikbarim, that sometimes you have something that's asur bahana. So there are different kinds of yisurei hana in the Torah. Some things are asur bahana because they're bad, and some things are asur bahana because they're good. And some things are asur bahana because they have negative elements to them, so we have to make sure they're not around. And some have a status that we're not supposed to use them because they're too holy. It's interesting, we have Nezer, just parenthetically, we have Nezer and Hilchos Tshuvos, and it's a similar, as Hilchos Tshuvos, it's the time of year, and Hilchos Brachos, and it's Tshuvos and Hilchos Brachos, so he writes, I think it's in Siman Lamed Hey, that he gets very frustrated with the idea that we're all familiar with from the Beis Medrash. We talk here, especially those of us who are inheritors of the Brisker tradition, so we talk about it in Nesra Chefza and Nesra Gavra. So it's often frustrating because it looks like the terminology is not so clear. What exactly is what? So the Aben Ezer says in a tshuva, he says he thinks the whole thing is very frustrating because you want to say Yisur Chefza Gavra, like we talked about in the beginning by Yisur Derabanan and Yisur Deraisa. Can't you just use whatever term you want? Every Isser, the object is Usser, and it's Usser for you to do it. How do you decide what's really the terminology? So he uses a whole different definition than we've seen elsewhere. And he says that the distinction is that an Isser Chefza means that the object is bad for you. The object is lower than you are. You are above the object, so the object is dangerous spiritually for you. While an Isser Gavra means the object is higher than you. So you, as the individual, will be offending the object by using it. So things that are Kodesh are considered to be an Isser Gavra in that sense. So I think that's the distinction, something along those lines. So basically, you have different directions where something can be prohibited. Some things are bad, are Usser because they're too bad, and some things are Usser because they're too good. So what exactly is the nature of saying we have to destroy, we have to burn the oil? Is that because it's Kodesh, so it's a proper way of addressing it, you can't just throw it out? Or is it Davka that we're saying it's a Takala, it's dangerous because we don't want you to use it for something else, so therefore we have to get it out of the way, we have to make sure it's not around. So it seems like here you really have both components, that it's a Takala, that we're afraid you're going to come to use it in violation of this din. Or there's also this aspect that it's Kodesh, like the Balamor and others who followed in that path. So therefore, the Maisa, the post can recommend that ideally you should burn it the way the Shulchan Aruch says, because that's the Kodesh component. But if that's very difficult, burying it is also theoretically an option, because maybe it's really the Takala component that is driving this. Lamais, the Mishnah Berurah does recommend that to avoid all these issues, that one should have intent, following this resolution of the Pesach and the Shulchan Aruch, that the Taz quotes, that one should have intent when putting his oil in his menorah, or the candle in the menorah, that he is only makzid for the time of the mitzvah, and that it shouldn't continue afterwards, and then it wouldn't have any prohibition that's going to follow. Hi.
That doesn't answer the question.
If, which case, what does the answer? If you have intent that you could use it afterwards, that they only max.
So then, you said like.
Right, so if you do that, then that'll just get you out, that'll avoid the whole issue. And if you don't do that, so then the halacha seems to be that the way it's written in Shulchan Aruch is that you should burn it. So the question is, does burying it also work? So the way the poskim seem to approach that issue is that it might be that that's really what it's about. But l'chachila, burning is better because that is possibly also necessary from the Kiddush angle, and therefore that's the recommended. So the best approach is to have in mind that you're only being miyached this oil for the time of the mitzvah, and therefore you shouldn't have the issue. That's what the Shulchan Aruch commentaries do endorse that as the possibility, all working off this assumption that it's all an element of your intent to begin with. So the Rishonim were really only debating about what is your intent when you put it there. So if you have explicit intent for it to be something else, that should save you from the issue. But failing that, burning it is what the Shulchan Aruch says, and burying it might be an option, but a less preferable option. Jonathan?
So if you're in a situation where you are going to end up burning it, so Mishnah, you would have the same Isra Hana, whatever flamed out produced, because the whole point is to not get enough.
Right. Right. So that would be for your benefit. Okay, so again, there's a lot more to say about that, but I think those are some of the major issues about the sugya, which is the back half of the sugya of Asur v'Lishtamish La'ara. And what we've left over, since we want to talk about Yom Kippur for a few minutes, so what we'll leave for when we come back is Shamish, because again that comes up later in the daf, so we'll allow that to be a separate sugya anyway. And what's really a non-sugya, but if it's a sugya at all, it kind of attaches here, is maybe we'll say a few more words about the concept of a kli, by a menorah, the notion of the Avnei Nezer, that possibly the menorah may have its own halacha, so we'll maybe spend a few minutes on that after Yontif. But any questions about this? So okay, everybody good? Everything makes sense? All right, so let's just say a few words about Yom Kippur, Shechal, Yos, B'Shabbos. So, in the interest of time, we're really just going to highlight some of the issues. And you can look up the Marmakomas that I gave you today, point to a lot of the Psakim and the Shulchan Aruch, so you can look at them inside. We'll just call attention to what some of the issues are. So when Yom Kippur falls out on Shabbos, there are a couple of unique points. One isn't so unique in practice, but at least it was a little bit of a discussion. The Gemara was Daf Yomi about a month ago. And Daf Nun Gimel and Psachim has the whole discussion about lighting candles for Yom Kippur. And this is very nogeya to the parak that we're learning here, if not so much the sugyas, although our sugyas do often draw a parallel from their Chanukah to Neir Shabbos. So we light candles for Shabbos and Yontif. So what's the story about Yom Kippur? So the Gemara over there has a discussion that Yom Kippur, Makom Shenagu, there was some places where they had a Makom, a Minig, to light candles for Yom Kippur, and there were other places where they had a Minig not to. And then the Gemara evokes, but Yom Kippur, Shechal Yos B'Shabbos, so then that has an additional component because the question of Shabbos candles becomes relevant. So it seems that Shabbos candles and Yom Kippur candles, when it's not Shabbos, are really coming from very different places, but they all kind of converge. That the Gemara suggests that the issue of candles on Yom Kippur is really there because one of the inuyim is Tashmish Shemitah, the husband and wife are not supposed to be together. So the question is, what will help discourage that? Will leaving the lights on help discourage that for the tznius issues? Or will having lights on help, or will it create more temptation for Tashmish Shemitah? So the Gemara is not sure what the best Eitzah is, so it's two different approaches, Davka have lights or Davka don't have lights, and the Gemara invokes, it's interesting, I think Alpi Derech HaMusar, the Gemara invokes in that context, V'yamech Kulam Tzadikim, that your nation is all Tzadikim, they all have the same goals, they just have different approaches, sometimes opposite approaches to getting there. So I don't think the Gemara means to say that this pasuk is talking specifically about this conflicting minig, but it's an attitude that we would probably be well served to have in other contexts of life also. That very often we fight with people, we argue with people, and we feel as if we're arguing over values when really we're arguing over strategies. So that's an important distinction to make, and it would lower the tensions to a great degree. So that's what the Gemara says here, that Amech Kulam Tzadikim, everybody means well, they have different ideas as to how to get there, and here's an example of that, two conflicting approaches for the same thing. So the notion of a candle for Yom Kippur is really very different than the candle for Shabbos that we have. But why do we have a candle for Shabbos? So we'll get into this in more length. But Pashtus is, it's a fulfillment of Oneg Shabbos, that it's to have the ability to enjoy our Shabbos, specifically in the context of eating. It's ironic that the pasuk that tells us that we have an obligation to eat on Shabbos is the one that we read in the Haftorah, the one time we read the Haftorah on Shabbos is the one Shabbos when we don't eat. Because it's the Shabbos, it's the Haftorah for Yom Kippur. So when Yom Kippur falls out on Shabbos, we read this Haftorah on Shabbos, and it's kind of taunting us because that's the one Shabbos when we're not eating. But the pasuk, the karas l'Shabbos oneg, l'kdosh Hashem b'chubad, that appears in Sefer Yeshaya, it's read, it'll be read in the Haftorah on Yom Kippur. So that's how we understand that we have midivrei Kabbalah, an obligation of oneg Shabbos, an obligation of kavod Shabbos. So does oneg Shabbos exist on Yom Kippur? Does oneg Shabbos exist on Shabbos and Kippur? It's a good question. It's not so clear that there's room for it, that if it's based on eating and things like that, so if you don't eat on Yom Kippur, so maybe there is no such concept of oneg. So it's an interesting discussion, the question of whether there's oneg Yom Kippur, even when it's not Shabbos, is there a concept of oneg? The B'tzel HaChachmas, Vassal Stern, in his Chuvas, he quotes from the Marashag. The Marashag was a Talmud of the Maram Shik. The Maram Shik was a Talmud of the Chassam Sofer. So the Marashag was a grand Talmud of the Chassam Sofer. So he understands that there is an Inyan, it's an interesting concept, that there is an Inyan of oneg on Yom Kippur. And to kind of a little bit of synergy to our Gemara, that says that if one would afflict himself more than necessary in Yom Kippur, let's say somebody's going to say that he's going to go beyond the Inuyim and he's going to try to treat himself in a low-down way to feel afflicted in Yom Kippur, so the Marashag has this idea that that would be a bizui yantiv. It's like a bizui mitzvah that he would be disrespecting the yantiv, that essentially Yom Kippur is a yantiv, a day of simcha, maybe a day of oneg, and we are constrained in certain ways by the Torah's requirement of atayness, but anything beyond that would be a violation of oneg. A fascinating idea. But others suggest you don't really have oneg on Yom Kippur. Maybe you have kavod. So the Gemara, I put this on the Mar Makomos, the Gemara in Daf Kuf Yutes, and Yisach HaShabbos does seem to say pretty clearly that there is a concept of kavod on Yom Kippur. And the Meiri comments that since you don't really have oneg, because the normal venues for oneg are not possible on Yom Kippur, so therefore you have to emphasize the kavod even more strongly, the kavod which at least is represented, for example, with nice clothing. So that becomes your whole venue for kavod of the day, and all the kavod and oneg eggs are in that basket, so then you have to emphasize that even more strongly on Yom Kippur. It's interesting, there is a minig, and a minig is a din, it's probably a din d'oraisa actually, it's derived from a pasuk, that we have to have a suda on Erev Yom Kippur. We have to eat the lashon of the Gemara and Brachas and Daches, the last parak of Yuma. The Gemara says that kala ochel v'shosa v'tisha malav akasiv ki'ilu husana tisha v'asiri, that you have an obligation to eat on the 9th of Tishrei. And there's a machlokus rishonim as to what the purpose of this is. If you look in the Ritva, in his commentary to Rosh Hashanah on Daf Tes, he quotes from the earlier rishonim, he quotes all the rishonim as different views on this point. And then the achronim have some very creative things that they added to the list, so you have many different theories what this notion of eating on Erev Yom Kippur is about. But in the rishonim, basically two schools of thought. Now one school is that it's there to prepare for the tainus, presumably to make the tainus more bearable, the way most understand it, or to, as the Ritva there says, you shouldn't come to have to break your fast because you decided, hey, it would be cool to start fasting 24 hours earlier than I have to, so that's a bad idea. You should eat more the first day so that you're able to successfully finish the tainus. But some of the Rishonim say that it's an issue of kavod yantif or oneg yantif, that really you're supposed to have, or if simchas yantif, depends on what the proper term is, that you're really supposed to have the suda for yantif, that really, in its essence, Yom Kippur is a day like any other yantif, but we have technical obstacles, that we really should be having a festive meal on Yom Kippur, but there's a big technicality that gets in our way, it's the Issacharis of eating, so we push it off beforehand, we have a suda, we cover Yom Kippur in the hours before Yom Kippur. So this is part of a mentality that maybe Yom Kippur is really a day that's yantif like any other yantif, should have all the relevant dinim, but we're constrained, so we express in whatever way that we can. So it's a whole discussion, maybe we'll spend some time on this and talk about some of the various Hanukkah topics that contrast with this. So Neir Shabbos, what is the category? Is Neir Shabbos a function of kavod, or is it a function of oneg? So the Vilna Gaon has a distinction in Hilchos Yantif. The Vilna Gaon writes that the difference between oneg and kavod is whatever you do before Shabbos, and oneg is what you do on Shabbos. Which is why some point out that people who want to be explicit about their meals on Shabbos and they say l'kavod Shabbos Kodesh, then maybe you should say l'oneg Shabbos Kodesh. That if you're eating on Shabbos, that's midin oneg. So there's a whole discussion, what exactly is the purpose of Shabbos candles? Is that an expression of oneg, that you want to have candles lit on Shabbos, midin oneg, that you should be able to see your food? Or is it that it's midin kavod, that this is part of the environment you create before Shabbos, and it's a way of honoring Shabbos beforehand? So this could have ramifications when you have Shabbos, or even if Yom Kippur is not Shabbos, you have this day where you're not eating, so how much of the mitzvah still pertains, how much still carries over. It's interesting, the idea of candles being relevant to Oneg, the Gemara in the beginning of the 8th Parak of Yuma, in the context of Yom Kippur, the Gemara notes that the Pasuk says in the Torah, V'yancha v'yarivecha v'yachilcha saman. Pasuk in the beginning of Parashas Ekev says that Kadosh Baruch Hu provides us with the man, and he uses this language of Vayancha. It's an inui, like Yom Kippur. So what do you mean it's an inui? It's the opposite of an inui. Inui is fasting, the man is eating whatever you want. It's the best non-inui there is. So the Gemara suggests that the language of inui is there because even though this is such a wonderful gourmet item, and you could eat whatever you want, you could taste whatever you want, but it's always going to look the same. You could imagine a juicy steak, but it's still going to look like this glob of bread, however you want to describe it. And you could imagine a donut, it's still going to look the same. So whatever it is that you're tasting, you're not able to see. So the Gemara says that no matter how good the food is, if you can't see it, you're missing something from the experience. This is what the fine chefs know, that the visual appearance of the food has a big impact also. So that's what the Gemara is saying, that if you can't see the food, you're missing something significant. So Oneg Shabbos, if you're really supposed to enjoy the meal, so then you have to be able to see it. So that's what Neir Shabbos are there to provide. So that's a question, to what extent is that relevant on Yom Kippur? There is also a question that there's another component, you have to see how that fits in. That dafka is going to come up in our Gemara in the context of the Hanukkah sugyas, where the Gemara suggests another purpose for Neir Shabbos. The Gemara says Neir Shabbos are there because of Shalom Bayis, and contrasted with Neir Chanukah in that context. We'll get to that, God willing. It's a fascinating idea that what seems to mean is that people tend to fight with each other over little things. It's a big Musar Haskel. That we're worried, shall you kashal the eighth of heaven, that people are going to trip over the furniture in the house, so they're going to start sniping at each other, they're going to start fighting. So we don't want that to happen, we want there to be shalom bayis, so therefore Chazal ordained that there be lights on, and some of the Rishonim understand that it's not even just Shabbos, but during the week too, that there should be lights available so that people aren't going to trip over each other, and they're going to avoid these fights. So it's a big Musar Haskel about the goal of Shalom in the Torah, that we see that sometimes that means that you should remove all the minor things that people fight about in order to reduce the opportunities for conflict. That's also a part of Shalom, which you find that idea in Halacha in many places. So here the Halacha says you should have light so you're not going to get into a fight so much. So all of that would mean that perhaps on Yom Kippur as well there is such an idiom. So Lamaisa, that's what Shulchan Aruch writes, that we have a minhag to light candles for Yom Kippur, and especially Yom Kippur Shechalos for Shabbos. And Shulchan Aruch even says, make a bracha on this minhag, which is surprising, because the Shulchan Aruch generally follows the view of the Rambam, that you don't make a bracha on a minhag, and this minhag seems to be a little bit more solid. And Mishnah Berurah explains that once you have this minhag, so then Shalom Bayis makes it obligatory. So that's the practice, to make a bracha on these candles. And we also have the practice of putting them in the dining room, even though there isn't any meal there taking place. So the Acharonim explained that that's midin kavo, that that's considered still to be the prominent place of honor in the house, even if there's no meal taking place. I once suggested, I mentioned to Rosh Hashanah once, that maybe you could say that if kavo means what you do before, also if the eating on Erev Yom Kippur is midin sudas yantif, so then maybe that's why we have the candles on the table, because of the suda of Erev Yom Kippur. To which he pointed out that that would make more sense if the candles were somehow servicing the meal, but the candles come after the meal, so it's not really such an adequate explanation. But that's nonetheless the midik, to light candles in the dining room, even though there isn't a meal taking place. in conjunction. So that's one of the major issues. There are a couple of other issues that come up, just to mention them very quickly. And again, if you look at the Maamar Kolmos, you'll see some discussion about them. So one question is, in terms of Havdalah, there are some differences. So normally, you make Havdalah Motzei Yom Kippur, so you use a candle, just like we do Motzei Shabbos, but it's really a different reason. That we light a Havdalah candle Motzei Shabbos because God told all the Harishon how to make fire on Motzei Shabbos, so we commemorate that and we make a bracha of Bari Mare Haish. Motzei Yom Kippur is different. On Motzei Yom Kippur, we want to highlight the difference between Yom Kippur and Yantif. Normally on a Yantif, you could use a flame that's there for Sarach HaChol Nefesh, for cooking and for related purposes. You could do that. Yom Kippur, you can't. So we want to emphasize that, so we take a light that was there, and we now say, after Yom Kippur's over, now we could use this light. So for that reason, Yom Kippur, when you make Havdalah and you use a candle, it has to be a candle that was already in existence on Yom Kippur. And if you don't have any candle, if you'd have to light one fresh, so then we skip the bracha. That the bracha is only there if we actually have in existence a candle that was there from Yom Kippur. So the Mishnah Berurah notes that when you have Yom Kippur that falls out on Shabbos, so then you could be makel to say every other Motzi Shabbos you could light a new candle and you make a bracha bari mara eish. So Yom Kippur, that Shabbos, ideally you'll still have a candle that was there before, but if you don't, you can rely on the fact that it's Motzi Shabbos and light a new candle that would work as well. There is also a big suffix about Pesamim. This is a whole complicated issue that normally Motzei Shabbos that we make a bracha on Besamim, and that's part of the Havdalah ritual. And the understanding is that that's there to restore our neshama or restore ourselves after we lose our neshama yisera. Then on Shabbos we have the neshama yisera, and Motzei Shabbos it goes away, so we don't want to faint, so we have the Besamim to keep us going. So if that's the case, does it have any place on Motzei Yom Kippur, even if it's Shabbos? So some assume no, that some assume that if you're not eating anyway, so the Neshama Yisera is there as part of the, is there as part of this eating issue, because Rashi and Beitza says the Neshama Yisera means you have more room to eat more. So if you don't have eating taking place, it's not relevant. So therefore, maybe there's no place for Besamim. Others disagree. Others said that even if you want to take this understanding of Neshama Yisera as being so food-centric, the fact that you're not eating in practice doesn't mean that it's not there. As they point out, what would you say, let's say if somebody's poor and he doesn't have any food on Shabbos to eat? So he doesn't have Neshama Yisera? He has Neshama Yisera, it's just not being used. So too on Yom Kippur, even if we're not actually eating, presumably have Neshama Yisera also. So it was a machlokas whether or not Pesamim had any place in Motzei Shabbos / Yom Kippur. So what's the practice? So in the Shulchan Aruch he says not to have Pesamim, and the Ramah doesn't argue. But then the later commentaries, they all say that probably does make sense to have Pesamim. The Taz and others say it does make sense to have Pesamim. So then the question is, all right, so it's not a bracha l'batala, as they point out, because you can make a bracha m'sam whenever you want. It's a bracha sanenin. So whether or not there's an actual chiyuv is not a problem with bracha l'batala, but it seems like it's a problem with hefsek. Why should you randomly, in the middle of your havdalah, all of a sudden decide to make a bracha sanenin if it's not obligatory? So should we worry about hefsek? So that's what some were concerned about. And they had all kinds of eitzes that each one has a problem. Some said that maybe you should make a bracha on Besamim first before you start Havdalah, and then make Havdalah. Others say that's not, and then maybe you should smell the Besamim in the middle of Havdalah without the bracha, because you made the bracha beforehand. So they have various objections to that, and maybe that's also going to be a hefsek, but even without the bracha. Others say that maybe you should make Havdalah, drink the wine, then make the Barim and Besamim. And the response to that was that that's also not productive, because it's all supposed to be a la coast, and once you've drank the coast, you're not going to accomplish anything there either. So a lot of back and forth. Is there any eitza to deal with this, other than just accepting that we make a normal Havdalah like a Motzei Shabbos and not worried about the issues? So it's interesting that this actually parallels the question that we had last week. That on the second night of Rosh Hashanah, so we have a practice to have a new fruit on the table, because we're worried that maybe the Shachianu is not necessary in the second night of Rosh Hashanah. So we want to have something else there to justify the Shachianu, just in case. So the post can ask, how in the world does that help? That if the Shachianu, let's say, is going to be connected to some fruit that you're eating, so then why are you doing that in the middle of Kiddush? Isn't that a hefsek? So you have, if the Shachianu was for Kiddush, then fine. But if you're saying, well, maybe the Shachianu was for my new fruit, so then isn't that a hefsek in the middle of Kiddush? So how do you deal with that? So there are probably two approaches to the question, other than trying to get around it. But there are probably two approaches, which both could address this issue of Shaman Motzi Shabbos as well. One approach, some posts can point out various proofs to this effect, that if you make a bracha in good faith that you think you're obligated to make, even if it turns out that the reality is you're not obligated, so then that's still not a hefsek. So if you think that you're making a shachianu because you might need to, or that you're making a psalmim because maybe it's necessary, so then that's not going to be a hefsek, even if Papi Shmaya Galia or Yoa Novi can come and tell you later that you weren't really obligated. That doesn't make it into a hefsek. The intent for it to be accomplishing a halachic purpose is already not a hefsek. There's a very interesting approach that Rav Sternbuch has in his Sefer Moedim Muzmanim, where he suggests that with Kiddush and Havdalah, he says really the whole nature of the institution is that it's a type of Shira al Hayayim. That the format that we have, Chazal instituted a praise to God over a cup of wine, and therefore they also felt that they could include other praises to God as part of that process. So he says that in addressing the question of Rosh Hashanah, where he says that even a Shachianu for an extraneous purpose is therefore acceptable within that context. But he says, in general, when it comes to Havdalah, he says that's the pshat, that why did Chazal put all of these extra brachos davka there in between the Bari Pirag Ofen and the bracha of Havdalah? So because it's all a part of this idea, it's all a Shir al Hayayin, so we're allowed to be somewhat expansive in what's included. So therefore, it would come out that even if it was not relevant to Havdalah at all, could be justified in that context, so presumably on Matzah Yom Kippur Shabbos could also be justified in that context. A couple of other issues which we're going to run out of time in a minute, so just mention some of them. You know, we have a practice, it's machlokas whether to say Avinu Malkeinu or not, but normally we don't say Avinu Malkeinu on Shabbos, but Mishnah Berurah says that Yom Kippur Shabbos we do because it's Gemar Din. Others disagreed, others thought that the one hecker of Shabbos and Yom Kippur when it's both the same day is that you don't say Avinu Malkeinu. It's a question whether it's considered to be an issue of Shelos Tzrachim on Shabbos, as some understood. So that was a machlokas, affects other things as well. Normally we don't add to the Aliyahs on Yom Kippur because normally the rule is that you can add to Aliyahs on Shabbos, you can have as many Aliyahs as the Pesukim can accommodate. But on Yontif, the Aliyahs are specific. They reflect the Kedushas Hayom, so you don't change the number of Aliyahs on any day other than Shabbos. Only Shabbos, which has the most Aliyahs anyway, so Shabbos is 7 and up, but everything else, Yom Kippur, Yontif, Rosh Chodesh, we don't play with the number stays the same. So strictly speaking, as the Mishnah Berurah and others point out, that if Yom Kippur is Shabbos, then because it's Shabbos, you should be able to add Aliyahs. However, he recommends against it because he says the way the Aliyahs are broken up on Yom Kippur is done with a specific theme in mind. It has a theme of tshuva in it, so it's best not to play with that at all. But strictly speaking, midin yontif, you probably could because it's also Shabbos and Shabbos would govern it. He also points out, and the Ramah points out, that if the shul auctions off the Aliyahs and makes profit for Saka from selling the Aliyahs, so they get more, if they can make more Aliyahs, that might justify it. In a related note, the Ramah himself mentions that, of course, the one very notable exception to not adding on Aliyahs on Yontif, what's the one exception? That's the question. I remember by Simon told me a story once that, if I remember the story correctly, that in Satmar they had, in Shavuos, they had too many Chassanim around, they couldn't give an Aliyah to everyone. So they did a gorol to decide which chassanim were going to get them. And there's a certain very big Talmud Chacham who's among the chassanim, and he lost the gorol, so he wasn't going to get an aliyah. So whoever was the authority in that Satmar minyan, Paskin, they should make a hosaf on yantif for Chavra Torah, he should not be left out. But there is one yantif when we do add aliyahs coming up. Simchas Torah, right? So the Rama adds that we know we had many, 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 many aliyahs on Simchas Torah. That's an exception to the general rule that if we don't add aliyahs. But so Shabbos and Kippur may be an exception in theory or in practice, depending on what's emphasized. Major issue, which we won't have time to discuss in detail, but you can look up some of the Makaris talk about this, is the question if a chola has to eat on Yom Kippur. So a question in general, whether he should make Kiddush, because technically speaking it's Yontif, should we say that he's Yotzei of Kiddush and Davening? So he doesn't have to make Kiddush Aliyayin, maybe the institution of Kiddush Aliyayin is only on other days. It's a famous story which I was like relating about the Abenezer when he was 5 or 4 or 2, get younger whenever you're retelling the story. So he was eating on Yom Kippur because he was 2 years old. So his father said to him, "Avne, it's Yontif. If you're going to eat, maybe you should make Kiddush." So he responded, "Why should I make Kiddush?" He says, "I'm not Chayiv Mitzvahs." So the only reason I'm going to make Kiddush when I'm 2 years old is to train myself to make Kiddush when I grow up. When I grow up, I don't plan on eating on Yom Kippur, so why am I going to practice making Kiddush on Yom Kippur? It doesn't have any toelas. So that's in terms of a cut. But in terms of a chola, an adult chola who's eating, so then there's a whole discussion whether he should make Kiddush or not. And then the discussion says, even if you say you shouldn't make Kiddush, then there's no institution of Kiddush on Yom Kippur, no matter who you are, if that's the position you take. But maybe it's different if it's Yom Kippur Shchalios B'Shabbos. Shabbos has been Kiddush by itself. So if somebody has to eat the Shabbos, maybe he should make Kiddush for that reason, even ignoring the fact that it's Yom Kippur. So that was a big discussion in Poskim. That's the whole story in of itself. But there's very quickly allude to another issue that's relevant to sugyas that we'll get to in the beginning of Shabbos when we start focusing on that. So we know that there is a concept of Chatzishir Asur Min HaTorah, that basically means as follows. That normally, let's say, if I'm going to eat a kezias of chametz on Pesach, or a kezias of chazer, so I'm subject to a punishment, karis of chametz, and malchus by chazer, whatever it is. So that's only if I eat a kezias, if I eat the shir. What if I have less than the shir? So that's called chatzi shir. Anything less than the shir is called a fraction of the shir, or chatzi shir. And the Gemara says, opinion of Rabbi Yochanan, which almost all the Rishonim follow, is Chatzi Shir Asur Min HaTorah. But the question is the other opinion, Rish Lakish's opinion, which isn't generally accepted, is that Chatzi Shir is actually only Asur Min HaRabbanan, that Min HaTorah there is no issue, it's only Asur to have a Kedayis and up, and less than that is Nisa HaRabbanan. So based on that, Rabbi Yosef Engel quotes in his Sefer Tzvino Motorah from the Tzemach Tzedek, and a few others have this question, but why don't we say the following, that when Yom Kippur and Shabbos coincide, so maybe we should obligate one to make Kiddush and to eat a kezias. Why? Because Yom Kippur is different than all the other eating-related averus in the Torah. That Yom Kippur, as the Gemara says in Yuman Daf Pei, Yom Kippur is one of the two exceptions to the concept of kezias when it comes to eating. Normally, says the Gemara there, that kol isuri achila b'kezias, Chametz on Pesach and Truma and Trefus and Bas B'chol is all the Kezayis. But when it comes to Tumas Ochlin and also Yom Kippur, so the Isser is bigger and the Isser is different. So Yom Kippur, the Isser is a Posevus, which is larger than a Kezayis. Why is that? Because, as funny as this sounds, there's no Isser Achila in Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur is not about the prohibition to eat. Yom Kippur is about fasting. It's about being in a state of Inui. You're supposed to be miserable. So the understanding of Halacha Moshe Sinai, of the Chazal, whoever it was that the Shirim were transmitted, is that anything less than a Kosavis, you're still pretty miserable. You're still fasting. That in order to break your fast, you have to have what Chazal called here Yishuv Hadas. You have to have some level of satisfaction, and a small amount is not considered to be satisfaction. So the question was asked, at least according to Reish Lakish, that Chatzi Shir is Nisa V'Rabbanan. So why don't we say that make a Kiddush on Yom Kippur, even not on Shabbos, make a Kiddush, specifically let's say on Shabbos, make a Kiddush on Shabbos and Kippur, and have a Kezayis to be Mekayim Suda Shabbos, working off the view of the Rashba and the Chuvas, that there's a Chiyuv Daraisa to have a Kezayis on Shabbos. So you'll be yotze a mitzvah d'oraisa, and you'll only be violating this at the rabbanon because a kazayas is less than a kosevis, it's technically a chatzi shir. So why don't we create that suggestion that that should be an eitzah for Shabbos? So he has there are a couple of approaches to this question. We're clock's about to run out, talking about chatzi shir. So just to mention very quickly, one is the approach of Yor Sameach. Yor Sameach has an idea that when you have Shabbos and Yom Kippur on the same day, it's not that it's Shabbos and Yom Kippur, it's that each one's Kedusha defines the other. They become a new entity. It's not just Shabbos and Yom Kippur, it's Shabbipur. It basically it becomes a united entity. And on Shabbipur, there was never a mitzvah of Kiddush. Just like according to the post, we say a Chola doesn't make Kiddush on Yom Kippur because there's no institution of Kiddush on Yom Kippur, if that's true. So Shabbipur also, there was never Kiddush. There was never such an institution. So therefore, we don't have to worry about that or the fact that it is. Another approach that was mentioned by great Gaon, the Shlomo Warman, Zechazad Kavach, who just passed away a month ago. So he suggested that we have a concept in halacha that sometimes we recognize, have two different areas of halacha that have different rules, but they're intersecting at the same time, so the standard that works for one works for the other, even though that's not otherwise the case. So for example, this is based on a Gemara in the context of Sukkah, that the Gemara says that the shear for a mechitza on Shabbos is higher than the shear for mechitza in a Sukkah wall. But the Gemara says in Sukkot on Daf Zayin that during the week of Sukkot, whatever qualifies to be a wall for a Sukkah also qualifies for a mechitza on Shabbos. The Gemara has this expression, Migo de Habidofen Linyan Sukkah Habidofen Linyan Shabbos, that since we acknowledge it as a wall for halachic purposes in the context of Sukkah, even though it wouldn't normally make the cut for Shabbos, here it does. So you could say here as well that Migo de Havi Achila, in Shabbos Havi Achila in Yom Kippur. But it doesn't make sense at the same time to say that I'm machshav this as a meal for the purposes of a Shabbos Suda, but I'm not machshav it as breaking my fast. That if it was Stam Kazayas and a normal Yom Kippur, it wouldn't have any significance. But if we're going to give it halachic significance and that it's supposed to be a Suda Shabbos, then by its very nature, that's also going to shter Yom Kippur, and that's one of the reasons why that has not been the accepted eitzah, besides the fact that we don't pass much for Shlakish anyway. But it's an extensive discussion, but we'll have to wait for the next Yom Kippur Shabbos to say more about this. I wish everyone a Gemara in the Nova.